This is PodTech.net. I'm Jason Lopez at the VentureWire Healthcare Innovations Conference in Redwood City, California, on September 12, 2006. Among the speakers at the gathering, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's Drug Evaluation Chief, Dr. Stephen Galson. In this keynote interview, Galson tells Brian Gormley, who is an associate editor of the Dow Jones publication Venture Capital Analyst, what's on the mind of the FDA.
Thank you. Well, for any biotechnology company or especially pharmaceutical company, the regulatory pathway for their particular drug in their sector is, of course, a primary concern. But I think nowadays we're all thinking a lot more about the regulatory environment for drug approval overall and what the balance should be between checking of public health and also the bringing important new products to market without any undue delay. And yet, as important as the issue of drug safety is, it's really only one of a number of important matters that the FDA is confronting right now that are also very important to the industry. Just to name a couple, the reauthorization of PDUFA, user fees, biogenerics, and also just a general modernization of the way the FDA handles review of pharmaceuticals and the way it works with industry, try to improve the success rate in clinical trials. So to try to get some insight into how the FDA is working with these and other issues, we're going to be talking with Dr. Galson, who's head of the Center for Drug Evaluation Research at FDA, which is, of course, known best as the gatekeeper for pharmaceuticals, generics, certain biopharmaceuticals, but it's also involved in oversight of manufacturing, labeling, and advertising. And toward the end of the program, we'll be taking your questions. We'll set aside about 10 minutes or so for that. So I'd like to just kind of jump into the issue of drug safety. FDA has always been asked to walk that tightrope, and now you're kind of walking the tightrope with a hot spotlight on you.
Right.
So I was wondering if you could just talk about how does that, how are you thinking about that balance of safety versus benefit and what does that mean for venture-backed companies?
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, Brian. First, I'm really happy to be with you all. I think our communication with the financial industry and investors is one of the most important relationships that we can have. And I started talking to the financial industry a couple years ago when I realized how much lack of understanding there was between this community and FDA and the realities that we face. The first thing about drug safety that people need to know is that we're in an extremely dynamic situation right now, today, this week, next few weeks in Washington. The Institute of Medicine, part of the National Academy of Sciences, is going to be issuing a report that they've been working on for a couple years. It's funded mostly by FDA, but by other federal agencies as well, which is going to, again, it's under wraps. We don't know what it's going to say, but they have been working over the last year and a half or so to look at a comprehensive evaluation, both of how the agency handles drug safety and how the whole U.S. healthcare system handles drug safety. So this is something real important to pay attention to because these recommendations, and again, I don't know if they'll be ones that we can adopt or embrace or they're going to be ones that the agency disagrees with. No matter what they are, they're going to be important. They're going to be discussed a lot over the next period of time. The other thing that's very important going on in Washington is that there's a bill that has been introduced by Senators Enzi and Kennedy, bipartisan bill over the last few weeks, which is going to get a lot of discussion, which makes some very, very important, proposes to make some very, very important changes in the agency, particularly with our statutory ability to require more data to be produced by companies for the agency. So again, those are very, very important things happening in the legislative policy world in Washington that although I know from working with this community over the last few years, sometimes people just hate to pay attention to it and they think Washington is irrelevant. It's really not, and it's particularly important with regard to drug safety right now. The central question you're asking is to how do I see the balance of benefit and risk with pharmaceutical products or risk and safety, however you want to put it. And again, it's difficult to answer in a general way. But one of the things that I work very hard at in communicating is that all medical products, and this goes beyond the center's responsibilities to medical devices and other sorts of areas where the agency regulates, that there's always some risk that gets balanced against the benefit of products. And I think you all, as risk takers, you understand that intrinsically. The problem is that a lot of Americans don't understand it, and they think if there's a product approved by FDA on the drugstore shelves as an over-the-counter drug or generic or other kind of prescription drug, that it must be safe, quote, safe. And what safe means to many, many people is that there really is no chance that they will be harmed at all by using or taking that product. And we all know at FDA, and physicians know that are trained in this, and certainly I know you're aware that every pharmaceutical product has some chance of risk. And if what we're really looking for is a risk-free environment, we'll never have innovation, we'll never have new products, and we'll be in a real static situation with public health. So I think one of my key goals in the center and with FDA as a whole is to continue to try to educate people about that. We have been exploring recently ways that we can do better at communicating about that balance, but also ways that we can try to quantify a little bit more what we're looking for in certain disease areas so developers of products really know the threshold that they have to meet. Right now, it's really quite subjective. Companies make an assessment about whether their product's risks are outweighed by the benefits, and then they ask FDA to look at that and buy into it in making an approval decision. And there have been examples where there's just been a disconnect, where a company really felt that the benefits outweighed the risks, but our reviewers didn't. And so I think personally that there's room for a lot more transparency about the methods that we use, the thought process that goes on when we make these assessments.
And are there certain specific examples that come to mind where you're providing more guidance to industry with regard to a particular type of drug or a particular class of products?
Yeah. We are working on a number of guidance documents, and these are the documents that we put together to help industry. They're not binding, they're not requirements, but they give industry and developers a sense of what we're looking for in certain disease areas. And these are very, very difficult. For example, a group of drugs that we're working on in this area is a diabetes guidance, a guidance for what our expectations are with drugs to treat diabetes. And if you all are familiar with the area, you know that there have been a number of really spectacular failures of diabetic drugs for diabetes. And most of these have not been risk-benefit problems that have been addressed, and then we realized that we made a mistake. It's that the safety profile of the drug was not properly understood before. And this is another one of the dynamics that is very difficult for members of the public to understand, that we will never know everything about drug safety when a drug is approved. And if we wanted to have perfect certainty about the risk profile, again, we wouldn't have any products because the clinical trials would have to be so huge. And this is a debate that is going on. So we're trying at these disease-specific guidances. We're working on specific cancer products, prostate, breast cancer. So we're working on guidance documents in those areas where there are a lot of companies working to develop products and there is not complete certainty. A lot of the chronic conditions I'd like to see, and we're beginning to work on guidance for arthritis products, obviously an issue that there's been a lot of problems in the last few years.
When will they be coming out, or something?
I don't want to promise any dates, but there are some that are out already in draft that are available, and there are others that are in the works. So we're hoping over the next few years that we'll have more of this kind of guidance available. I think that's very, very important for developers to know.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we talk about some of the specific measures you're taking to try to increase drug safety. I know you're looking at new types of data. You're looking at prescribing data. And linking those without actual outcomes.
Right.
Could you talk a little about those
efforts? Sure. Well, the major reliance that we have now after a drug is approved are what's called spontaneous adverse event reports. These are reports that come into us from industry or from practitioners or even consumers that want to send these individual reports of problems that they've had with drugs after approval. They go into this huge database. We get about 500,000, almost 500,000 of these reports a year. And they're very, very challenging to try to determine for each particular case whether the report is actually a result of something related to the drug or whether it's related to the underlying disease that the person has, the reason that they took the product. So it's time-consuming, it's expensive for us to maintain, and the overall quality of that data is, it's helpful because that's all we have right now, but it's always a question when you have these reports, whether they're linked to the drug or when there's an article in the newspaper about a specific drug, we get a huge increase in reporting. And so how do you compare the rates after a newspaper article about a drug and before, and how can you look at trends? So what we're looking at is new ways of getting better information post-marketing. And there are a lot of different examples of this. Just one that I'll talk about is working more closely with the payer organizations, something that always makes the pharmaceutical industry nervous, but this is a very positive step, and that is because the large payer organizations, the Center for Medicare Services with the Medicare Drug Benefit, Kaiser, the Blue Cross, insuring tens of millions of people, they have data in their systems that covers what drugs people are taking and then also what their medical outcomes are, because they pay for both ends of the spectrum. So by looking at a group of people, for example, taking a statin drug for their cholesterol, we can look in a very unbiased, neutral way at what the medical outcomes are. So if we're getting a lot of reports of people having liver problems from a statin drug, we can go into their database and really look at what's happened for tens of millions of people without regard to whether the reporting rate has increased because of a newspaper article like I mentioned. So it's better quality data. These databases are growing, and the payer organizations are better able today than they were 5 years ago, and in 5 years it'll be even better to put these databases together across many millions of people. And that quality of data after a drug is approved is going to eventually be used and be a lot more accurate about what's happening with drugs after approval.
And how will that be? How would that data that you collect and the information that you have, how might that be translated into the way you work with smaller companies? If you're, if you identify one a product with a particular concern, how does that translate into similar products that are coming through the pipeline?
Right. Well, what we've learned is that we can make conclusions about products and transfer those conclusions to other products if the products are very similar. So this will enable us to better be able to predict after approval what's going to happen with the safety profile, which again enable us to predict before we make approval decisions what is likely to work, what is likely to not work in the labeling discussions that we have with industry, which are sometimes, you know, difficult and time consuming and contentious, frankly. There's sometimes a disagreement about what the companies want to put in the label and what FDA wants to put in the label. What we hopefully will be able to do in the future is look at label language that has worked in preventing potential adverse events, take those lessons, and apply them to the labeling discussions that take place before products are approved. So I think the improvements in information technology, in the collection of these large databases, is really going to help developers be able to better predict which products are going to work and what the features of those products are going to be surrounding the regulatory process to be more helpful.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, there's only so much, you know, as I think you alluded to, there's only so much you can find out in the clinical trial process. And I know that historically when FDA has approved a product on an accelerated basis,
right,
based on some kind of surrogate endpoint, you have required post-marketing studies as a condition of approval.
Yes.
But to what extent are you going to require post-marketing studies for products that reach market without an accelerated approval?
I don't see us requiring more studies. We already have at the point of approval for some products, we reach agreements that are called post-marketing study. Companies agree to do post-marketing studies that aren't part of an accelerated approval process, but they're things that we still, answers that we think still need to be addressed after a drug is approved. I see that the creation of these databases as enabling those studies to be done more easily, more cheaply, without big investments in separate clinical trials, because you can look at the data being collected by people on the drugs and sometimes reach conclusions. So I see it dovetailing very, very nicely, and maybe even requiring us to ask companies to do fewer of these studies than we do now, because there'll be other ways to get the information other than the company investing in a new study.
I want to just touch on the issue of user fees. I know that's something that needs to be addressed. It's a program, I believe, started in 1992. Mm-hmm. It's been expanded a couple of times since then. And I understand now you're looking to maybe perhaps expand it a little bit more. I was wondering if you can talk about that.
Yes, there is. We're into what's called the negotiations for PDUFA 4. That's the Prescription Drug User Fee Act. This is the fourth round of negotiations, because the program's last 5 years, and the PDUFA 3 is expiring at the end of fiscal 07, which is starting at the beginning of October. So we've been talking to industry. We've been getting input from outside stakeholders about goals and what outcome measures we could use at FDA, what requirements that we could have, goals that the agency could work on to try to improve the user fee structure. One of the things that people don't understand too well is what it really takes to run a robust regulatory process at FDA. We really seek to have the very, very best qualified experts that we can get, and we're in really intense competition for those experts with the pharmaceutical industry. So it's tough for us in the restrictive environment of federal hiring practices to offer people the right salaries and benefits to attract people to come to the agencies. And this has been, you know, an ongoing challenge for FDA. We've gotten a lot of support from the industry in improving the funding of the center and the agency over the last few years. But we're somewhat at a crisis point right now, because our costs have been increasing dramatically, just as they have around the country in running businesses. They have for regulatory agencies as well. And I'm personally concerned that we're losing our ability to attract some of the best people. And it's really in industry's interest, and certainly in our interest, to make sure that we have the very best systems, the best management programs, the best experts at the agency. So we're investing a lot of time in working with our partners, both in industry and other stakeholders, to try to work out a funding structure for the program that will help us in the next decade, make sure that we're at the cutting edge, we can interact with industry in the way that's necessary, that, so that we understand their needs and get more products on the market. That's the key goal here.
I know another way you're working with industry is through the critical path. And I remember when you announced the program a couple of years ago, there was a very sobering statistic in there. I believe you said that a compound entering phase one in 2000 was no more likely to reach a market than one that entered phase one in 1985. So obviously there's a lot of room for improvement there. And I was wondering, Where are you with the critical path? Mm-hmm. What achievements have you made to date with regard to identifying biomarkers, surrogate endpoints, and so forth?
Right.
And where do you plan to go from here?
Yeah. One of the biggest impediments, and those of you that have worked in product development know this as well, is really the predictive science in drug development. So a product may look very good in an animal model, give it to a few people, or you try to extrapolate from another kind of product, and it looks great, but it's not until you get into late-stage clinical trials that it becomes apparent that a drug really is not working the way you thought. And these surprises continue to happen. And that's why the efficiency of product development is very low. And added to that, there have been changes in regulatory requirements. There have been changes in medical legal environment that have further acted to increase the cost of developing pharmaceutical products. What the Critical Path Initiative offers is a way for FDA and industry and hopefully Congress and the taxpayers as a whole to invest in improvements in the science of drug development. So how can we predict early on in development of a product whether it's going to result in a safety problem down the line? A lot of the promise of this has to do with the promises that we've heard of in personalized medicine and pharmacogenomics, that by understanding the genetic predictors of drug efficacy and drug safety, we'll be able to determine earlier on in the process what helps a product work or not work. Part of it, though, is using the expertise that has been gained through years of reviewing products at the FDA. And that's one of the things that we think hasn't happened very successfully. Our experts who've been at this 10, 20 years, they know what a successful application going through the process needs, and they know the things that don't work. But there hasn't been a great exchange of information between us and people in the early phase of drug development. So what the project aims to do is to invest in the science, but also invest in getting our people to work more closely early on in the drug development process with developers so that the communication level is very high, so that the lessons that we've learned can be applied in those development discussions that take place, and we can improve the success rate. But all of this is going to take investments in science, bringing in outside partners, having those partners work in new ways with the agency and with industry, producing guidance documents, looking at pharmacogenetic determinants and trying to do experiments and studies to see whether they're actually going to be effective, do biomarkers, et cetera.
And is this, I imagine this is going to require, we're looking to identify biomarkers and patterns that correlate with drug response. It's requiring industry to share more data, be more open about it, and this is not something that pharmaceutical industry has been too keen on historically.
Right. It's not a natural stance for industry for obvious competitive reasons. But what we've been able to do, and I think some of the scientific leaders in industry are really buying into this, is that the whole drug development enterprise can be improved by selective data sharing about products when companies are looking at similar products or when we are trying, for example, the most common adverse event that occurs that interferes with the product coming to market is liver toxicity. And so it's important to a whole range of different companies and different kinds of products, from heart disease to arthritis to diabetes, and even orphan products, it's the same story. So how can we predict which products are going to run into problems with liver toxicity? This is a common problem that is causing, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to be lost as these products get into the end stage and you realize there's a liver problem which is not going to be able to be surmounted. So in a case like that, companies collaborating on the pharmacogenetic profiling of their products early on to try to see, is there a way to predict earlier in development which drugs are going to run into problems with the liver? It benefits all of the companies without them really losing any sort of competitive advantage, because they can't, with one set of information, reach the same conclusions that could be reached if you put all the information together. So it's those sort of examples that will help, I think, convince people in industry that sharing data when they normally haven't is very, very beneficial. And I think we've made a lot of progress in that. The toughest part is setting up the rules of engagement, really, on the sharing. I think we've surpassed the threshold of convincing people that it makes sense to share the data. It's more, how do we do that? Who's going to hold the data? What are the restrictions on keeping it confidential? How is the agency going to use it for regulatory purposes? We've made a lot of progress with some guidance documents that we've put put out on pharmacogenomics, explaining that we're interested in the agency in getting this information on genetic profiles in very early and how we're going to use it or not use it for regulatory purposes. In other words, we want to learn from this data without necessarily using it to make approval or no-go decisions, because we may not know enough from that information, and trying to get over the natural fear of the companies about giving us this extra information. I think we're making progress. We sort of know the way to go, and we are looking for more support from outside the agency for moving forward with this critical path program, because it's going to take additional people and additional expertise in the agency to really make it work.
Mm-hmm. I know CDER itself has undergone a reorganization.
Yes, yes.
What does that mean for the pharmaceutical industry?
Yeah. Well, there's nothing more boring to audiences than talking about reorganizations, but I'll do it succinctly since we're running out of time anyway. What we've tried to do is do some organizational changes within the center to help us better be able to communicate around the Critical Path Initiative. So that's the main thing, making sure that we've got the right people working together, communicating, setting strategies so that we can work with companies around the critical path type of projects. And the second area of reorganization that I've been focused on is around drug safety. And that has to do with addressing longstanding problems between our units in the center about how they communicate about safety issues both before approval and after approval, and again, improving how we communicate to the public, because that has been an issue. You look in the newspapers and you see that there's a lot of misunderstanding about drug safety findings. So we really want to improve how we communicate to all our stakeholders, both the patient population, consumers, and physicians about drug safety issues. So that's been another focus of the reorganization, try to improve that area.
Well, I know another aspect of your kind of reaching out to industry is end of phase 2A meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Traditionally, you meet after phase 2. Some people think that's a little late.
Yes.
Can you talk about that phase 2A meetings?
Yeah, the number of meetings that have taken place between industry and FDA over the last three, four years has risen dramatically, has doubled, and depending how far back you go, even tripled. So we now hold thousands of meetings every year between our staff in industry. These are very, very important, and although it requires a huge investment of time and resources for the agency, we have to prepare for the meetings, then, of course, conduct the meetings, and then afterwards all the follow-up information and exchange. But we think the increase in these meetings is actually critical to improving drug development, to giving companies early phase information about what they need to do to get the product, increase the chances for getting it through the approval system. So it's, again, one of these areas that I'm very pleased to be investing in. I think we have to invest more, but we do need the resources to have the people to conduct these meetings. And again, I'd like to push them as early as we can, as soon as a company is interested in coming in and talking to us. One of the things that we're working on, which, you know, it sounds mundane unless you're involved in drug development and then you know that it's not really mundane, is how do the communications between the regulators, between my staff and companies, actually take place in these meetings? You'd be amazed at how one person comes out of a meeting thinking that A, B, C were agreed to, and the next person thinks D, E, F were agreed to. So there's even a problem, even though we're holding these meetings, of recording what happens and making sure that there's complete clarity coming out of the meetings of what was agreed to. So we're actually working on some very, very important process improvements in how we manage meetings, how we record our meeting minutes, and the communication after meetings that may be, to me, as important as holding more meetings is the process around how they're held and how the results are communicated. So this is something that, you know, is very, very important that we have to invest more in.
We've got a few minutes left, and if anybody has any questions.
It'd be helpful if you'd identify yourself.
Thanks. David Johnson from BioCrossroads. I have a question for you on the databases you were talking about earlier. A lot of those are being developed, as you suggested, by the payors in this industry. And it's my understanding that in some cases, the quality of data there, being reimbursement and claims data, is
right.
not as rich, even though the scale of it is huge. It's not as rich as what many of the discovery and development companies are used to using and probably that you're used to reviewing.
Yeah.
Question for you on that, with all of the initiatives on payers to develop that data,
yeah.
is the FDA trying to guide that process, and also are you trying to get the discovery industry to be a part of that so that you can end up having mm-hmm. one or two or sort of several preferred sets of that data? Because I
yeah.
can see you could have a lot of competing information of varying quality if you don't do
right.
that.
Right. That's an absolutely right on target point. It is a concern. As I've tried to explain, it's obviously more complex than I have time for here. There are severe data quality problems with the adverse event reports that we get already. So even though it's claims data, when you're looking at post-marketing questions, there are some real advantages to it because it's not affected by reporting rates as much as the data that comes in spontaneously through the adverse event reports. But you're right, the level of detail in the data is not like what we asked for clinical trials or for post-marketing commitments. We are working with some of the payers. We've got some good projects going on with CMS for what's called the Part B data and then the new databases that they're developing in Part D, the new benefit, to try to improve the situation. I think this is one of those areas, though, for us to really get involved with companies and payers in a robust way, we would need a lot more people working in this area, and we have really a handful of people, a small handful working now, and it's going to, I think, be quite some time before we're able to make progress. So this is one of the areas in our funding from Congress and our funding through the user fees that I'm hoping we can build up. If we can, we will, and I'd like to do a lot more work with people on the outside to improve that data in the claims databases so we can use it better. Excellent point.
Ranging to move from China, we're working on botanical drugs. Mm-hmm. We know that the botanical drugs is recognized by FDA as drug in 2004 by receiving the guidance on
yes.
botanical drugs. Because the nature of these drugs is different from the chemicals and the biologicals. I wonder, FDA right now, you're drafting a further initiatives or further guidance on these products? Because one guidance may be...
yes. I'm not aware of other guidances that are under development, but as you know, the Center for Drugs is very large. There are many, many guidances underway. There may be things that our botanicals team are working on and that are in the very early stages. So the botanical guidance that we put out a few years ago, I think, is a huge step forward. We'd like to develop more. If you have ideas of what you think the real impediments are to developing more botanical products, you know, let me know and we'll look into that. Thanks for bringing that up.
One last question.
Hi, Ben Ferrer. I'm with BD. I have a question on the guidance documents that come out. Sometimes they don't come as a surprise, but it seems like when you get our input, it sometimes takes a long time before they come out, and the venture capital world works pretty quickly.
For example,
just last week, I think this, I forgot even the name, it's these algorithms that combine, I think the FDA called it multivariate index algorithms or something. They come out and then suddenly it shakes it up because the timelines get dramatically extended
right.
for when these companies can get products.
This is the biostatistical guidance?
Exactly. Or,
okay, yeah.
So, well, this is not in your agencies in the device one.
Ah, okay.
So are there any other areas where you are really thinking actively that you want to start regulating where you currently really don't, maybe in drug-device combinations or anywhere else?
Well, in the drug-device area, as you all know, there's been a large increase over the last decade in the number of products being developed in this area. We've created an organization inside the agency to deal with some of the jurisdictional issues and to deal with some of the scientific issues such as drug-coated stents, one of the largest product areas, and then others as well. So it's not as though we're starting to regulate in these new areas, but we're trying to improve the transparency between our scientists and industry in working on guidance development. And there are dozens of these guidances that are in the works at any one moment. We have a limited number of people, and that's why it takes so long. They're also very tough scientific questions. Thank you.
I think we're about out of time, so I want to thank Dr. Galson.
Thank you very much.
Enjoyed it.